Welcome to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. Today we're focusing on a variety of psychological conditions that affect many of us. We begin with a portion of my conversation with Susan Cain. She's an avowed introvert, former Wall Street lawyer who joined me a few years ago following the publication of her book Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. She's since gone on to become a TED Talk All-Star and to form the Quiet Leadership Institute. It's aimed at fostering better office practices for introverted workers. Let's take a listen to my 2012 talk with Susan Cain. I have to say, when we booked the show, I said to our producer, she can talk, right?
Yeah, you know, it's so funny. I get that reaction a lot. And then the other reaction I get is surprise at the fact that I actually can talk.
Exactly.
You know, and I think that's such a funny question in a way. It's a completely understandable one, but a funny one because the statistics actually show that 50% of Americans, believe it or not, are introverts. So when I speak of introverts, you know, I'm not necessarily talking about a hermit who never leaves their house. You know, I'm really talking about kind of you and me or people we know. It's really one out of every two or three people we know who are introverts. And what I'm trying to shine a light on is that there are a lot of people out there who are kind of passing as extroverts, but who are still living in a world that is set up to deplete their energies because it's really set up for extroverts.
As you mentioned, maybe a third, maybe as much as a half of the population might describe themselves as introverted. What do you think the qualities then of an introvert are?
Introverts tend to be deep and reflective thinkers. And, you know, you can even see this in tests in the lab. If you give introverts and extroverts sort of difficult problems to solve that require a certain degree of persistence and really thinking things through, you'll find in these kinds of problems that introverts tend to do better. They spend more time thinking about the problem before they actually tackle it, and they spend more time solving it, and they more often get the right answer. And you know, and then we see this in the real life workplace as well.
Do you think introverts, and again, we're speaking broadly, of course, knowing that the people are much more complicated than this.
But
do you think they have that? Unlike extroverts, who I think are stimulated by stimulation, if you know what I mean.
I do.
Do you think introverts are sort of overwhelmed by stimulation?
Well, you know, sometimes it's overwhelmed and sometimes it's something a little less than that. But yeah, you're getting really at the heart of what makes an introvert an introvert or an extrovert an extrovert. And that really is what level of stimulation do you need to feel at your best, at your most alive, at your most energized. So introverts tend to enter that sweet spot with a much lower level of stimulation, and whereas extroverts really crave more stimulation to feel at their best. And we're talking now not only about social stimulation, although that's a key component, but it's other kinds of stimulation too, like levels of background noise, for example. You know, there's an interesting study by the psychologist Russell Gean who found that if you give introverts and extroverts math problems to solve, the introverts do better with lower levels of background noise, and the extroverts need higher levels of background noise. And this is such an important thing to understand because, of course, when we're designing schools and workplaces, there tends to be only kind of one level of stimulation on offer at any given time. And kind of by definition, that can only serve half the people in the room.
Do you think introverts get confused with people who are shy? Do you, in your own mind, see a difference between those kinds of people?
Yeah, that's a really important question. They are very different. So introversion is what we were just talking about, you know, how much stimulation do you require? And shyness is really different. That's just about the fear of negative social judgment.
And that's very different than having these personality traits.
Yeah, it is different, although, of course, you know, culturally and in the public mind, these two traits overlap, and psychologists find that to some degree they overlap, too, in the population, although they really debate to what degree, and the overlap is not all that high. Mm. You know, so just as an example, Bill Gates seems like a person who is quite introverted. Most people describe him that way, you know, quite reserved, quite private. But he doesn't seem to be fazed by other people's opinions of him.
Susan, I have to say, when I finished reading your book yesterday, I said to myself that I feel like I'm both an extrovert and an introvert. And I think many people are a combination of all the things that you and I have been talking about.
Yes, yes. And you probably saw that there there's a word for people who really fall right in the middle of the introvert-extrovert spectrum, and they are called ambiverts. Hmm. So it sounds like you're an ambivert.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you're suggesting, even for people who really more or less fall on one side of the spectrum or the other, we're all still a kind of glorious mishmash of traits.
Right.
And even Carl Jung, who was the psychologist who in 1921 first popularized these terms, introvert and extrovert, even he said there is no such thing as a pure introvert or a pure extrovert. And what Jung said was, such a man would be in a lunatic asylum. So I think that's important to remember.
You mentioned something earlier about introverts in the sense passing as extroverts.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess because, and I think it's true in many ways that we do value that more extroverted personality. Is that something that you have learned to do yourself?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's something that almost every introvert learns to do to one degree or another. You know, you learn it from a very early age, from the time you enter preschool, really. And the question is, to what degree do you do it? And are you doing it a reasonable amount of the time, or are you doing it too much of the time so that you burn out?
You know, I was also thinking, as I was reading your book, that I had an extroverted father who was married to, frankly, an introverted mother. I mean, you know, that they had very different personalities. And clearly, having read your book, one was an extrovert and one was an introvert. I don't think that's so unusual, though.
I agree with you. And, you know, it's funny because most of the studies that I've looked at about married couples show that about 50% of the relationships are introvert-extrovert pairs, and the others are people who marry, you know, someone of like type. But I have to say, in my anecdotal experience, almost every couple I talk to tells me that they're a mix, you know, one introvert, one extrovert. And I think that this is because the two types really need each other and are drawn to each other and understand that they complement each other. You know, it really is a yin and yang, which is important to emphasize because I think, you know, you could look at the title of my book and think that I'm calling for like the overthrow of extroverts, and that's not it at all. My husband's an extrovert.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I love extroverts. I'm just calling for a balance between the two.
Let me talk a little bit about the workplace. Workplaces, many workplaces prize things like brainstorming sessions, and you know the walls have been torn down between desks, and it does at least attempt to foster a more cooperative relationship. How do you think an introvert deals with that kind of a work environment?
Oh, I mean, I know how they deal with it because I've interviewed so many of them. They're silently going nuts a lot of the time.
Too much stimulation.
Yeah, too much stimulation, too much being on all the time. And then also, it's not only the too muchness, it's also the not enoughness.
Oh.
You know, there's not enough time to go off by yourself and work autonomously in the way that introverts crave, and in frankly the way that their employers should be happy that they crave, because that kind of work can generate pretty amazing stuff. You know, so I think it's really a loss for everyone.
But do you think that the brainstorming, such as it is, that's overrated?
I really want to be clear about this because I'm not calling for the end of teamwork or, you know, the end of the exchange of ideas at all. I think there's really a place for that. But I think what is overrated is the idea that all creativity and productivity comes from this collaborative place, which I think is, you know, where our workplaces tend to be right now. And in fact, you know, 40 years of research on brainstorming has repeatedly found that individuals produce more ideas and better ideas than groups who are brainstorming.
That's so interesting because it seems such a valued enterprise, brainstorming.
I know. You know, one interesting thing from the studies, though, shows that there is a value to it. It's just not the value we're thinking. There's a value that people tend to feel an increased sense of trust. It raises morale. And people who have been engaged in a brainstorming project tend to think that they've done really well. Even though the reality may be very different. You know, there's a certain social cohesion that comes from it.
And for the introvert, I guess, it's the solitude, the privacy, the quiet that helps them think through a project or think through a problem?
Yeah, you know, that's right. And you can see this if you look at children in preschool, you know, who are acting exactly the way they want to act. You know, they haven't yet been socialized to conform to some norm. You can see that there are some children who really want to go off by themselves to play. And this doesn't change when they become grown-ups. This is still their basic preference. What I also want to say is there's value in this for extroverts as well, because the fact is that we are all such social creatures, introverts and extroverts, both of us. we're so social that if we come together in a group of people, we start to instinctively mimic the opinions of the others in our group without even realizing that we're doing it. This has been found in a bunch of different ways. And, you know, even something as seemingly visceral and personal as who you're attracted to, you will start to become attracted to people who other members of your group have deemed attractive. And again, you don't think you're doing it. You think it's just your own opinion that you've arrived at, but it's not.
We talked briefly about schools,
yes.
And schools run the gamut, of course. There does seem to be more emphasis on group learning, certainly than when I was in school, when we sat in our desks and tried to follow along while the teacher essentially lectured to us. It's more collaborative today. Can you talk just a bit about, I guess, introverts and what they need in a school environment?
Yeah, this is a deeply important question because the studies do tell us, and also all you have to do is watch an introverted child to know this, that introverted kids do prefer to work autonomously. They enjoy lecture formats. They enjoy that kind of individualized learning. When they are confronted with a school day that is mostly made up of group projects, it can really be... It's not just that it's overwhelming for them, it's just not enjoyable. You know, it's annoying, and it makes learning unpleasant. That's the really sad thing about it. I had one young woman just said to me recently that she really wants to go back to grad school, but she said, I just can't take the group learning anymore, so
really?
I'm not going to go.
Wow.
Yeah, and I mean, it saddened me, but it didn't surprise me. That's pretty typical.
But
I do want to say that there are like some degree of group learning when it's really well managed can be great for introverted kids because it gets them chatting with their peers in ways that they might not be comfortable doing if they had to raise their hand in front of the whole class.
But it sounds like you're also saying that the teachers and perhaps even schools need to understand the different styles of learning between children who are more extroverted and those who are more introverted.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's become very lopsided right now, and they do need to understand that.
I wonder, though, Susan, when, the so-called extrovert goes home, I have a feeling they need to recharge their batteries as well. They probably don't want to answer the phone or, they want a little downtime, too.
Yeah, everybody's on a spectrum with this stuff. And sure, we all, to some degree, all extroverts sometimes need downtime, just the way all introverts sometimes crave being around people. If I'm sitting at home by myself all day, I start to go nuts, even though I'm a pretty strong introvert. So these things aren't total and they're not extremes. They're just sort of tendencies.
That was Susan Cain, author of Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. When we get back, we'll continue hearing conversations about psychological conditions, this time with Daniel Smith, whose memoir Monkey Mind explored his anxiety-ridden life. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We continue our look at our psychology by listening to a part of my conversation with memoirist Daniel Smith. His book, Monkey Mind, examined his anxiety-filled life and his attempts to quell the paranoid and negative thoughts that permeated his everyday experience. He's a former staff editor for the Atlantic Monthly, and join me in our WHYY studios following the publication of his book. Let's take a listen. Are you anxious about doing this interview?
Strangely, I'm not. I was anxious beforehand for a while. I was biting my nails, biting my cuticles. But something about once you're in the middle of it, it cuts off the fear of the future, which is what anxiety often is, and sort of slams you right into the present moment. And for me, talking to someone even live in front of an audience, mm-hmm. all my anxiety goes away. I used to do some performance in college, and beforehand, I was an absolute wreck always, and felt tortured. But once I was up there, the anxiety dissipated. It was like meditating. It was like being always in the present moment. So something about that. Not everyone who's anxious
right.
is so lucky, of course.
Well, I'm glad you're not anxious, and we're happy to have you here. You, though, describe your anxiety as cerebral, and you have a wonderful phrase describing, I guess, how your brain works, a kind of drama queen of the mind. Help us understand what goes on inside your head that makes you so anxious.
Right. Well, the term that I think clinicians use is catastrophizing, so that anything that happens, even the most mundane thing, a thought might occur to me regarding that event. And it could be anything mundane like which salad dressing to put on my garden salad. Should it be balsamic vinaigrette? It should be blue cheese. Now, it seems like a very mundane choice, a very pedestrian choice. But for me, my mind immediately starts making a logical progression from that moment to catastrophic events. If I choose the wrong salad dressing, I'll have a bad lunch and I won't be very nice to the person next to me. That person next to me will say something terrible about me, who will say something to my editor, who will cancel my book contract, which will lead to me to being impoverished and then homeless. I'll take up drugs. I'll end up having to sell my body for money on the streets, come down with a horrible disease and die disgraced and alone.
Wow. A vivid imagination. Yes.
Yeah, dramatic, melodramatic mind. It is like having a drama queen of the mind. That's one great metaphor, at least for my anxiety.
Well, it's interesting because you do talk about your family and how you experience anxiety differently. And it sounds like, as you say, with your brother, it's more physical, maybe more kind of heart palpitations. But for you, it is this cerebral, your overactive brain, I guess.
Yeah, and I think my anxiety focuses on failure and on things going wrong, whereas my brother Scott, poor Scott, is having his little brother expose his anxieties to the world, but I think he could handle it.
Yeah,
Scott's is focused on illness. He's a hypochondriac, basically, so that, like a lot of people, he feels a twinge in his chest or muscle tightness, and his mind goes to heart attack, cancer, and he ends up in the hospital having a bunch of expensive tests.
Really?
Whereas for me, yeah, he's, you know, like a lot of people that happens to, they have a panic attack, they end up in the back of an ambulance. Emergency rooms see tons of people every year, thousands who are convinced they're having heart attacks but are really just in the middle of a moment of panic or deep anxiety. I don't go there. Although there are physical sensations for my anxiety, for some reason, I get fixated on the more abstract failure, separation, loss.
Do you feel like the world is a dangerous place?
I do. The world is a dangerous place. It certainly can be. And there's an aspect of pessimism, it seems like you might be getting at, that anxiety, and my anxiety at least, is related to a sense that the world is a dangerous place and the world is a threat to me. It's not my body that's a threat and that might sort of mutiny, but the world around me. Anything can go wrong at any moment and can lead through a cascade of events to my ruination. Sounds crazy the more I describe it out loud.
But it also sounds logical. I mean, in many ways, humans survive because we reacted to dangerous situations and we had the fight or flight response, and we were able to evolve and survive.
Yes, and except instead, there are no wolves trying to chase me down. There's just salad dressing in front of me. So it's right. I think it is very much this primitive impulse that is now channeled into these very mundane things, which is maybe one of the reasons why anxiety is considered a very modern affliction.
Because your mind has to go somewhere, so it goes to salad dressing instead of wolves?
Yeah, because we're not hunters and gatherers anymore, trying to escape predators, or at least most of us aren't. We are people who go to the grocery store and try to decide between Frosted Flakes and Cheerios. And we're faced with these choices, and our bodies, the mind is so absolutely great. It's a genius at fear. The fear response in human beings is vital. It's necessary. Without a fear response, we wouldn't have survived as a species. However, a lot of the things that we had to be fearful of are no longer threats, and yet we're stuck with the response.
You come from an anxious family, and of course that always raises that question about nature, nurture, you know, in trying to understand why you have this chronic anxiety.
Yeah, and I think that it's both nature and nurture. I come, as I say in the book, from anxious stock. And it's inevitable that children of people who have these anxious tendencies and whose parents had those anxious tendencies are going to experience them as well. Maybe not inevitable, but probable. At the same time, my mother especially struggled with enormous anxiety. She suffered from panic attacks from the time she was a teenager. And to her great credit, she found a way to deal with them. And now in her 60s, she is far less anxious than she's ever been in her life. But she's a therapist.
I was going to say, she's a therapist.
Yes, she went back to school to become a social worker, to get her degree, and to become a psychotherapist who specializes in the anxiety disorders. And I think, and she concurs, that this was a way of learning more about herself.
Well, it's interesting because you said she's a therapist and mm-hmm. helps people with their own anxiety and perhaps helping with her own anxiety. You write and have written a book about your anxiety, whether therapy and writing has the same kind of beneficial effect.
Writing has no therapeutic effect.
Okay, fair enough.
I get this question a lot, and you know, you wrote a book about anxiety. Did it help you with the anxiety? And it didn't. It helped me to understand the anxiety. It helped me to understand anxiety in general. So maybe I'm being a little disingenuous because understanding is therapeutic as well. But the only thing that's therapeutic with anxiety is changing the habits of thought. And writing comes with its own problems and makes you terrified that your work is going to be received poorly. So it raises its own anxieties. The only thing that's therapeutic is learning that how your mind works. My mind works in a certain way. I tell myself things that are going to make me feel anxious. Once I recognize that and learn how to be mindful of it, I can then try to dig new pathways. The problem is, I've been anxious for so long, since I'm a kid, and I'm in my 30s now, that the old pathway is always going to be there. It's like those wagon tracks that the old pioneers used to use to get across the country. So many wagon wheels would go in them that they'd be these packed earth ruts. They'll always be there, and the wheels will always slip in them. The only thing you can do is every day dig new tracks and dig a new pathway and keep digging them forever, because otherwise you're just going to slip back in the old ways of thinking. That's been my experience.
What's interesting, though, is that you use cognitive behavioral therapy as a way, I guess, of talking to yourself about what you're thinking. And you also use meditation, which I'm a failed meditator in that whenever I try it, my head just gets consumed with thoughts. It seems like such a contradictory or perhaps interesting way of dealing with your anxiety.
Well, it doesn't sound like you're a failed meditator. I mean, that's what happens. Someone said to me, and I'm a failed meditator too, in that I know it helps, but I don't do it.
Yes.
Because I'm a dummy. And even though I know that it helps, I don't know why I'm so dumb. I know what helps me, and yet I fail to do it every day. But that's what happens when you sit in silence, is that the thoughts come. Someone once said to me that the brain is like a gland, and what it secretes are thoughts. The secret of meditating, well, it's not a secret, I suppose. The rule is you allow yourself to do that, and then you just bring yourself back to the breath. It's a way of disciplining yourself from allowing your own mind to go off on those catastrophic tangents, those melodramatic tangents, and to bring yourself back. And that's why they call it a practice. Mm-hmm. And it has in common with cognitive behavior therapy that mindfulness, that awareness of the mind is something that does things that you might not want it to do, that makes thoughts that you might not want them to make. And you need to have some way of responding to that, some way to discipline your own mind, which is all that is. That's what both of them are.
Well, in fact, your book, Monkey Mind, I mean, that's a Buddhist term.
It is. I took that from the Buddhist literature, and I just found it so evocative, such a beautiful term to describe what it's like to live with a mind that's prone to anxiety, that's prone to this chronic dread and fear, because it feels like monkeys swinging around in your head and screeching and doing the disgusting flinging of their filth that monkeys do and not stopping, and learning to tame those monkeys, learn to put a collar on them, is the job.
But it sounds like with anxiety that there is a lot of I mean that there's a lot of focus on self.
Oh, it's awful. That's the great incantation. I. That's anxiety. It is being locked into your own head, and it is terrible if you want to be a good and loving person. Mm. When you're anxious, everything is about you and your own welfare, and it can be very hard to have productive, happy relationships when you're in the midst of that. It's like locked-in syndrome, I thought of it at one point. Like that book which was made into a movie, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
Oh, indeed. Fantastic movie, yes.
Fantastic and a wonderful book, and you're stuck in your own head, and it feels that way. It feels as if you cannot escape your own skull. And that makes it very difficult to see people well, to see them and to love them. And if that's an aspiration of yours, if you want to be a good person, it also comes with a great deal of guilt because you don't want to be selfish, and yet, and yet it's there. It seizes you like a fever, and it's a fever of selfhood, of self-obsession.
You described the anxiety that you had at camp. You also had anxiety about being dropped off at Brandeis, where you went to college. It sounds like you not just hid in the library, but you found great comfort reading books like Philip Roth's novels. That was a way for you to understand what you were going through. Can you expand on that?
Sure. Yeah, I had escaped the library because it was... It afforded some solitude. And I found that in books, I had a great therapeutic tool. I'd been in therapy before, and I didn't quite like it. You had to keep answering questions. if a book, and you had to sit there for the whole 45 minutes, otherwise you were rude or you're wasting money. With a book, you can open up the cover, and if it comforted you and it helped you and you taught you something, you can keep going. If it made you anxious, you could slam the cover shut and replace it on the shelf and get a new one. And they don't talk back. Which is a nice thing. So Philip Roth, when I discovered Philip Roth's novels, it was almost like discovering the Rosetta Stone for my own anxiety. We had very similar backgrounds, by which I mean we had slightly, or at least the characters, I should say, because I don't know Philip Roth and I don't know his life or biography that well. But the characters had histrionic Jewish mothers. There seemed to be an ethnic aspect to anxiety that I found quite true to my own experience. Often the dilemma that a Philip Roth character goes through is as follows. I want the love of my family. I cherish the love of my family. The love of my family is enormously important to me and defines me, on the one hand. On the other hand, I wish I can escape the love and affection of my family. I wish I could separate. I wish I could service my own ego. I wish I could be a bad person and not want to be the mensch all the time. How do you do these two things? You're being pulled in two different directions at the same time. And you can't get out of your head the voices of your family, of your parents, of your superego, who think they know what they want what's good for you. And perhaps do, and you might believe them at the same time as you resent them.
Daniel, I just want to quote something that you wrote. The headline was, Do the Jews Own Anxiety? And you talk about making up a baseball team or putting a baseball team together made up of anxious players. And you said, last Rosh Hashanah, I asked a group of friends this question, and the answer I got suggested that the team would be exclusively Jewish. Responses included, but were not limited to the following: the Los Angeles Kvetches, the Brooklyn Nazi Dodgers, the Kansas City Moils, the Chicago Schlubs, the Miami Michiganas, the Westchester Rhinoplasties, the Hollywood Ingestives, and my favorite, this is you, a late entry from my brother Scott, the Upper West Side Atavans. The idea that if you were to put a baseball team together of all anxious players, they would all be Jewish.
Yeah, and it turns out that it's not true.
Exactly.
The Jews do not have not cornered the market on anxiety. It's a universal emotion. And if you put together that baseball team, you'd have people like Soren Kierkegaard and William James mm-hmm. and Charles Darwin, who suffered terribly from panic attacks and crippling nervous illness, which they've tried to discover the cause of for many years. And half of the Book of Saints, the lives of the saints, those people would have to be in there. But the Jews are enormously good. And I should point out that despite the fact that my last name is Smith, that is what they call an Ellis Island name. It was either changed by my great-grandfather or by a clerk at Ellis Island. And it was originally Gamulski. But the Jews have been better than anyone else at dramatizing anxiety, at showing the dilemma of what it's like to be someone who can't get out of their own head. And, of course, we all know – we can all talk about the great examples, Philip Roth, sure. The Coen brothers movies, and, of course, Woody Allen. And there's good reasons for that. But I also think that it's very much an immigrant thing, an American immigrant thing. The other immigrant groups who come to the United States become very good at that, at representing anxiety once they start to experience the generational dilemmas. Do I stick with the traditional from which I've received so much, or do I assimilate and try to become individual and individualistic and independent? There's enormous anxiety in that tension.
That was an excerpt of my 2012 interview with Daniel Smith, author of Monkey Mind, A Memoir of Anxiety. We conclude our show about psychological conditions when we hear from author David Randall, whose sleepwalking problems led him to write the book Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. Stay with us. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We've been listening to my interviews about different psychological issues this hour, and we close out the show looking at sleep disorders. Author David Randall was a problematic sleepwalker and insomniac. The problem got so bad he decided to dive into the world of sleep-related research, only to find out that results have been ambiguous. Scientists are still trying to figure out why we need to sleep at all. We talked about the elusive nature of slumber when he joined me in 2012 to discuss his book, Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. Let's take a listen. Tell us a little about this sleepwalking incident, and there have been several where you have literally walked into a wall in your apartment.
The biggest one, the reason I kind of started looking into this book and sleep in general, was I went to bed one night a couple summers ago. Everything seemed normal. Then about 2 in the morning, I find myself, I wake up, I'm on my back in the hallway, got a searing pain in my knee, quickly figure out, hey, I've been sleepwalking, and I sleepwalked into that wall, and that really hurts. So I went to the doctor and spent a night in the sleep lab, did all that, and I came back, and he said, you know, I have to be honest with you. We know a lot about sleep, but there's a lot that we don't know. So the best advice I can give you is take it easy. And that was the first.
He said, thanks a lot.
Yeah,
right?
That was the first time I ever heard a doctor basically say, take it easy. You know, it was almost like I sleepwalked past the frontier. You know, the medical community could no longer help me. So I decided to find out, you know, why don't we know more about sleep? And if sleep is affecting me like this, you know, I'm walking into walls, it's got to be affecting other people too. So I wanted to find out all the ways sleep impacts what we do, how we raise our kids, how we live our life.
Did they have a diagnosis for you?
They said I had periodic limb movements disorder, which is, you know, on the totem pole of scary sleep disorders. Mm-hmm. It's on the very bottom, which basically means I kick.
And your wife can probably attest.
Yes, she can definitely attest. She moves all the way over the other side of the bed. It's almost like get out of the splash zone, if you will. And that was basically, they said, you know, we could give you sedatives at night, but we don't want you to take drugs that you don't need. And I agree with that. So I've, you know, basically just tried to do other things.
And have you had other incidents where you have walked in your sleep and hurt yourself?
Well, sleepwalking, researchers found, is drawn out by stress. There can be two components. There can be stress and a genetic component. Oddly enough, I learned I had the genetic component after I started working on this. My dad was telling me, oh, you know, I was a sleepwalker too. And he grew up on a farm in Kansas. And he would tell me stories of, oh, yeah, I woke up in the cornfields a couple times. And to me, that sounded more like an alien abduction than maybe sleepwalking. But, you know, stress too. Since the baby, I've been sleepwalking a little bit more.
Oh,
you know, sleep deprivation can do it. You know, not long ago, I woke up in front of the bassinet. My wife woke up and saw me swing my arms back and forth in front of the bassinet saying, I've got the baby, I've got the baby.
And you were asleep?
I was asleep. And thank God the baby was asleep in the bassinet. It had no idea the crazy things his father was doing.
So the fact that you, as a little kid, would sleep or at least fall asleep with your eyes open, yelling and screaming, making noises in your sleep, that all is part of a pattern of some sleep problems, at least, that you have.
Yes, and that typically that happens for other people, too. Someone who might sleepwalk, they as an adult, they might sleepwalk as a child, too. Sleepwalking for kids is actually very common. Something like 1 in 5 teenagers and below will sleepwalk at least once in their lives. As you get older, the amount of sleepwalking declines. Scientists still don't know why, however. And also the nature of it changes. Mm-hmm. When a kid sleepwalks, you know, generally they might walk into the hallway and it's easy to put them back down. And when adults sleepwalks, if you try to wake them up, they might act out violently. And again, researchers don't know why.
Well, you write about, or researchers told you about parasomnias, so that these are things besides sleepwalking that people have done in their sleep.
Exactly. It's almost as if any behavior you can think of that you can do in your waking life, you can do it in your sleep too. There have been many cases of sleep driving, sleep eating, someone having sex in their sleep, all these things, and then they wake up the next day and have no conscious memory of it. It's almost as if somebody else took control of their body and they're waking up and dealing with all the effects.
And were they on sleeping pills or some kind of medication that might explain this behavior?
It can happen both naturally and it can happen because of sleeping pills. Popular ones like Ambien, they now come with prescription on the labels. There's warnings that, you know, they've been found to have a higher rate of sleep driving, sleep eating. It's very common to hear people tell stories of, you know, I took an Ambien, then I went out, fell asleep. The next morning, I went to my kitchen and I saw half-eaten food everywhere. Or somebody else was telling me a story of, you know, he took an Ambien, he went to bed. The next day, his son said, "Hey, Dad, you were acting strange last night." And he was saying, "You know, what are you talking about? I don't remember that whatsoever." And his son basically said that the dad walked into the living room, started eating peanut butter with his hands, and then started praying in front of the TV. And he had no memory of that whatsoever.
Do we know why, or do researchers know why we sleep? I mean, I guess we should sleep about a third of our life. I don't think many of us do that, but nonetheless, why do we sleep?
That's a big question, surprisingly. Researchers know that basically we need 1 hour of sleep for every 2 hours that we're awake. Why we need to sleep, they're still not sure. We can see all the outcomes of it. We can see what happens if you don't sleep. You know, if you sleep continuously less than 6 hours or so a night, you are basically going to act, you're going to act like you're drunk. You're going to have less ability to solve problems. You're going to have less spatial awareness. You're going to be more impulsive. And then if you do that for a long time, your body's going to start feeling the effects of that trauma. You know, there's going to be higher rates of obesity, of diabetes. It can lead to heart attack, stroke, every other kind of this rogues gallery of health disorders. But that doesn't solve the question of why we and every other animal needs to sleep. One of the most famous studies, they sequestered rats and they thought, let's see what happens if a rat goes longer and longer without sleep. So a rat went 2 weeks continuously awake, and then, you know, these rats died. And in pretty gruesome ways, you know, their fur started falling out. They would have sores that wouldn't heal. And scientists, you know, performed autopsies to find out what exactly is it. And they didn't know. The best guess was, you know, going longer and longer without sleep makes you lose the ability to regulate your temperature. But humans, we still don't know.
Well, but what's interesting, and based on some of the research that you have done, is that many people do get less than 6 hours of sleep a night. And the question being, are they risking their health, either mental or physical, because of that lack of sleep?
Exactly. It's about one out of about every three working Americans, about 41 million Americans, gets less than 6 hours of sleep a night continuously. And there are health effects left and right from this. Not only are you danger to yourself, you know, heart attack, all those kind of things, you're danger to other people. About one out of every five car accidents are caused by a drowsy driver.
And are people not getting that requisite amount of sleep because they're watching TV, they're on their computer, they're staring at their cell phone?
There's so many reasons. All of the above, actually. There's part of the cultural reason. You know, it's so easy for us to think, you know, I have so many things to do. You know, I can dose myself with coffee. I can put off sleep. I'm so strong, I don't need it. And, you know, I'll sleep when I'm dead. When you look at the research, if you're saying I'm going to sleep until you're dead, you're not really living either.
No.
But then the other part of it is that so many of us sleep so differently than how our bodies are built to sleep. It's only been about 100 years ago that we've had so much electric lights because of the light bulb. Before then, we would sleep in two different shifts, and this was completely normal. You would fall asleep around 10 o'clock each night. You'd stay that way until about 1 or 2 o'clock. You'd wake up for an hour. You expected to wake up for this hour, and you'd spend that time in between just kind of relaxing. You might think about your dreams. You might read. You might talk to your loved one. You might have sex, you know, what have you. Then you would go back to sleep, and it was called the first sleep and the second sleep. The interesting thing with this was that researchers in the late 80s decided, let's see what happens, all the effects of all this electric light. So they sequestered people to see what would happen. For the first week or so, they slept as much as they wanted. They were like kids in a candy store.
And did they sleep a lot?
They slept, you know, 14 hours a night. Then after they kind of caught up on all that missed sleep that they didn't have, they started exhibiting the same pattern of this first sleep and a second sleep. It was as if their bodies were exercising a muscle that they never knew they had.
Well, in fact, you quote one of the authors of the study saying that time that they were awake was a period of meditation, that they felt very relaxed in that hour or so that they might be awake. And they would naturally wake up at that time?
Exactly. And they would wake up around the same time every night. And it wasn't just a feeling of, you know, they were half awake, so that's why they felt nice. They actually drew subjects' blood to find out what was going on. And they realized that they had a higher level of the hormone prolactin, which is the same hormone that chickens have in their bloodstreams when they're sitting on their eggs, and it's contented haze. So it really was a time when you felt relaxed naturally. And now what happens is that so many people might wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and they think, something's wrong with me. I'm supposed to fall asleep at 10 o'clock. I'm supposed to stay that way until whenever I want to wake up. So if I'm waking up, I need to make a change, and maybe I need to take a sleeping pill or something else. And they end up medicating a condition that's just kind of standard on the human body that we just don't know about, and many sleep researchers don't know about too.
But can we say that before the light bulb was invented, before we had so much artificial light, that this was probably how humans slept?
Yes, we can definitely say that. It's really changed with the light bulb and the popularity of coffee. When, you know, anthropologists contacted, you know, the Tiv culture in central Nigeria in the 1960s, and they were still sleeping this segmented sleep, and they basically had the same terms of first sleep and second sleep.
And is it because our brain is so wired that there's something about the light so that the brain convinces us that it's actually daylight, which makes it hard for us to go to sleep?
That's a big part of it. We have so many bright lights now, and you know, our bodies are built for a time when the sun was pretty much running the show. Mm-hmm. There was no bright light at night. So when we look at our TV monitors or our computer monitors or our iPhones or iPads especially, that bluish white light, our brains interpret that as sunlight. So there's this idea that I need to stay up longer. And if you're reading your iPad at night in your bed and then you turn it off and think you can just turn your head over and fall asleep instantly, that's asking your brain to do something that's completely unnatural.
You also have found from some of the research that people actually sleep better when they sleep alone.
Exactly. That was really interesting.
Yes. This
was a study done by a British researcher named Dr. Neil Stanley. And he basically thought, you know, what's the effect of sharing a bed? And he found that those who share a bed wake up about 50% more during the night than those who sleep in separate beds. And, you know, this is far from romantic. Most people
Indeed.
Share a bed because it feels good. So the idea was, you know, if your brainwaves say you sleep better alone, but then most people sleep together, why? Why does this work? And there's different reasons. You know, perhaps there's an emotional component to it. You know, it feels good to have somebody near you. And then there's also the idea that, you know, our beds are so much wider than they used to be. You know, if you have the California King and all these other beds, you almost are sleeping in separate beds. You can move away far enough away that you're not getting kicked. You're not getting jostled. And then the other idea is that, you know, if you do sleep in separate beds, there's more research that shows that if you have that conversation first about, you know,
it's not personal.
Yeah, it's not personal. I'm moving to a different bed, not because I don't like you, but because, you know, you have a sleep apnea device, you know, the CPAP, and it sounds like Darth Vader is next to me, and I'm not sleeping now. And another component of this, too, is that, you know, men tend to snore more often than women, and women tend to be very light sleepers. So it's almost as if women are dealing with the effects of a sleep issue, even though they don't actually have the issue. So the sleep issue becomes an issue. And that's one reason why separate beds happen.
Do you sleep in separate beds, or do you have a gigantic bed so that you're not kicking your wife?
We have as a gigantic bed as you can in a small Brooklyn apartment.
I know exactly what that apartment looks like. I was thinking about the fact that, you know, we don't generally sleep on straw, you know, pallets on the floor. For the most part, people have a, you know, pretty good mattress, maybe a pretty good pillow. There's so many things that we have created for ourselves to help us sleep, and yet we don't seem to have, generally speaking, the kind of benefits of that kind of furniture or material.
One of the most interesting studies I came across was, so there were researchers at a hospital in Germany, and they thought, you know, we have people in here all the time. We want them to be comfortable. What is the best mattress that we can have? You know, what is the one ideal mattress? And they found that there is no ideal mattress. It's basically what you're used to. So if you go into a store and decide, I'm going to buy a new mattress, the one you're going to find the most comfortable most likely is the one that you're already sleeping on right now.
The kind of physical imprint, I guess, which is why if you go to a hotel and it's not your bed, it just doesn't feel quite right.
Exactly.
Even if it's a very nice hotel.
Exactly. You know, it might be softer than you expect or lumpier or harder. All these other things that just makes us feel uncomfortable.
And our naps, there was a time when people, especially those who were struggling with sleep, were told, don't take a nap. You know, save up so that you can sleep at night. What's the research on naps today?
Naps are one of the best things you can do, not only for your body, obviously, but for your brain as well. Research has shown that those who take naps are able to solve puzzles faster. They learn information better. They make better decisions afterwards. And, you know, this nap can last from as few as 20 minutes to an hour, 2 hours. NASA has found, they did research with astronauts taking naps. And if they took a short nap, maybe 20 minutes, the effects were great in terms of they started paying more attention to all those kind of boring things that were so vital. You know, checking your oxygen level, checking off all the just going down the checklist of everything you need to do. The idea that, you know, maybe it kind of goes into the circadian rhythm in terms of when you should take a nap. Like trying to take a nap from 6 to 7:30 might be tough because then it's harder to go back to sleep immediately. But if you take a nap at 2, you know, 2 to 3, you get back up, you're going to probably go back to sleep at the same time. What we have what are called sleep gates. So these are times that it's easy to naturally fall asleep. Most of us have one, but around 2 to 4. You know, after lunch.
Siesta time, right?
Exactly. You know, some people might think, oh, I just had a big lunch. That's why I'm tired. No, it's also your circadian rhythm. It's naturally, that's a time when it's easy to fall asleep. 10 o'clock is a time that's naturally easy to fall asleep.
You just heard an excerpt of my conversation with David Randall, author of Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep. And that wraps up this edition of Radio Times in Review. Tell us what you think of the show. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.